Okay. Russ.
Well, welcome. We're glad you're here. My name is Doug Lee. I'm one of the pastors of Grace Fellowship Community Church. Just so you know, I was here for the first of the workshops, and so I'm going to introduce these guys, and then I'm going to leave. It's not because
out of here.
I found anything that they said distasteful and not worthwhile. In fact, I found it so encouraging and just a rich gift of the stories that I'm going to share. So, but Noah is a doctoral student in the School of Psychology at Fuller Seminary. He's been part of our EP gatherings, helping to lead worship. Mark is ending his six-year term on the board of EP. He's a professor at the School of Theology at Fuller Seminary. And Nina is currently doing work in spiritual direction and also working with the Missional Network, consulting with churches. I know them not primarily through those resume kinds of descriptors, but more as the long, steadfast friends of our congregation since the 1980s. They used to live in Oaks, across the bay from our congregation, and have really been a part of the life of our congregation in terms of just speaking regularly into our church's life and being with us in moments of grief and transition, and when we needed a word, a real solid word, speaking to us about our mission as a congregation and trusting in the call of God for where we are in our context, our neighborhood. They've been intercessors on our behalf, and I think we feel incredibly blessed to have them as friends, and we're really glad that they're going to be able to share their experiences and be able to offer that as a gift to this gathering. So enjoy.
Thanks.
Thanks. And stage left.
Yeah. Yeah, these friendships do go back a long way. A couple others here in the room that we really deeply appreciate. As I mentioned, we're going to just be running video, some pictures up on the screen. We're not narrating it. At times, our stories will actually relate, but it'll never be timed right. Also, if there's things that come up there that you want to talk more about, just make a note. We'll provide some time to interrupt. If we don't give you enough time to interrupt, do it anyway. But just for fun, at the far left is Noah. And then in Nina's arms is Nathan, who's 2.5 years younger. And then this happened to be a Sunday. We just asked him to send a video. And so they sent one where I was doing a lot of the leading of liturgy back when I had more hair and it was brown. And you'll also see later on during the actual communion liturgy that Nina's leading that. So we're all visible in this video. But other than that, we're not going to talk a lot about it unless that's helpful to you. I'm going to run the slideshow. It's got, you know, a handful of slides, and then I'll run the video for about the middle hour, and then I'll run the slideshow again. And so that way you'll just be able to see what we're talking about and then raise any other questions.
So we're going to talk about our life together in church and family from basically over Noah's lifetime. So Noah was born in 91, and we were already at Rockridge United Methodist Church. It was a church that the pastor that was there had been sent to either resurrect it or bury it, one way or the other, and it was resurrecting. Noah was like the first baby that was born into the congregation and was the only child present for a little while. It was located in an urban neighborhood in Oakland. So, Noah, what were some of your earliest memories of Rockridge?
So, some of the things, me being so young during these years, there's a lot of just feelings and affect around this congregation, and a lot of that has to do with how many, like, multi-generational worship, as, like, I'm with a lot of adults in some of these pictures, and the ethnic diversity. When you asked me to name friends during this time, half of them usually would be adults. I just did not know the distinction, and that played into the formation as I grew up and developed. And it would also be played out a lot in just how our communities were formed. And so that was even in the way we lived. Like, we were all often in either duplexes or community settings where eventually we ended up doing a co-housing with building on land behind the house that we lived in and having a 10-unit where different families moved in and we lived in community together. So that was kind of my initial thoughts and memories on that time. And so the question back is, was that intentional, or how much of that was intentional?
So about a year after Noah was born, a few other families came to the church. So there was this kind of more critical mass of children around, you know, that preschool, early elementary school age. So God did really get our attention with that in both the church and the neighborhood. We had already killed all the church committees because there had been this outcry of, you know, there weren't enough people to populate all the committees. So we ran an experiment, said we were going to just dissolve all the committees for 1 year, except for the ones that were legally necessary. And if anybody missed them, then we would kind of come back around and reconsider that. In lieu of them, we had groups we called Mission Covenant Groups, which is a Wesleyan kind of group, where the group was formed around a covenant of spiritual practices, and then alongside that, around a mission, a particular mission that the group does together. And that mission has an outward and an inward being within the church walls aspect to it. So one of the first groups that was formed was Celebration Mission Covenant Group is what it was called, and that was basically around worship. And so, but that was, there was an internal aspect of it, which was worship, and then there was an external aspect to it, how do we enable celebration in the community at large. So that was when we began to experiment more with just asking the questions about what did it mean that we now have a significant group of younger children among us. And we decided to experiment with declaring the year of the child. So for 1 year, we were going to attempt to look through the lens of what would this doing a particular activity, say worship on Sunday morning, what would that look like when we look through the lens of how is this enriching and nourishing for a child? Not so the year of the child isn't about idolizing a child, but about trying to look at whatever we were doing through the lens of how would this form and help and nurture a child. And we put that out there, and the church community affirmed that, and so we launched that, and we very much began with the Mission Covenant groups we had, which one of them was worship. So, Noah, what do you remember about worship?
One of the biggest things I remember is the freedom within worship, that it was a place where it wasn't confining, it wasn't be quiet, sit in your seat, but within that there was some structure. So some of the things that was there was always rhythm instruments throughout the sanctuary that we could play. There was different notepads that we could draw on. There was illustrated Bibles throughout the sanctuary. And within that you also, there was some structure, and then I found out later that there was actually a lot of structure. but I didn't know that. I didn't feel that. Like, you always were either sitting with your parents or what they called, like, pew pals, pew parents. And so you were, as a kid, you were always assigned to an adult. And often it wasn't your parents. It was often just another church member that had kind of taken you on and partnered with you. And so, like, probably around when you were 5 or 6, that's when you really entered into worship as a full member, as staying throughout the service, and not just, like, going out when the service started. And so how much of this was intentional, structured, and where were the things that you were thinking through as this time was created?
So as we entered into the experiment of the year of the child and worship, so Noah's already mentioned that we had rhythm instruments scattered throughout the pews that were for children of all ages. And one of the structure pieces around that was that we always had a percussionist as part of the worship leadership team. So the instruction was that you played when that musician played, and you tried to follow them. And then when they didn't play, then you practiced setting them down. So that's just one example of that there was structure, but there was freedom within the structure. And that we, in as many places as possible, we tried to not delineate, you know, like these are for children. So rhythm instruments, really anybody can use. As we move through the year of the child, a mission covenant group began to form around children, because we began to see how much that work was growing in richness and fruitfulness. And one of the things that we put out before the church community was whether to hire a part-time children's pastor. And at that time, there was maybe about 20 giving units in the church, and many of them were single, recently graduated from college, young adults. So that was kind of what the financial base was. And the denomination discouraged us because they just said this isn't viable. However, we gathered the church community. We put the vision out there about moving more deeply into this work, and said, you know, if you have a sense that this is something God is calling you to, call the church office in the next 24 hours and make a pledge, and we'll just see. If we have enough money, we will. If we don't, we won't. And in 24 hours, we indeed had enough pledged to move ahead. That Mission Covenant group got established. We moved more deeply into experiments with the intergenerational environment. We tried different experiments of both with, like, during the word time of having, like, Mark was preaching on the plagues one Sunday, and we had easels set up all over the sanctuary, and kids were each assigned a plague to in art form respond to. And so then they became part of the word that day. We experimented with Lectio Divina, because every child, everybody can notice what word stands out to them. We had a liturgical dance team that was an adult and a child. We had worship bulletin covers that had designs. For the Methodist, children are welcomed at the table, so that for us was not a big issue. We had, Noah mentioned, we called them pew pals, because we recognized that children needed more than their parents to learn what it meant to worship with a community of faith.
Yeah, that too.
And that parent, really, that's
more for the parents.
Where it came from was the parents were saying that we just feel like we can't worship if our kids aren't out of the sanctuary. So rather than saying, okay, then we have to send them out, we decided decide to experiment with pew pals. And so then there was a group of adults that said they would like to be pals. We worked through some resourcing of them. How do you worship alongside a child and enable them to enter into worship more deeply? Yes.
How was the response from that with the adults and the children?
In terms of adults volunteering?
Yeah, and like, what was their feedback, like if how they enjoyed it or how impactful it was?
I think from the adult side, there we definitely had enough adults that were willing to experiment with it, and we kept calling everything an experiment because we wanted people to know that this wasn't a program that we were going to force them to do and make successful. That we were going to try it, and we would keep talking about it and see if it worked, and if it worked, we would, you know, keep working with it. There were enough adults that did step forward. Do you remember anything that stands out to you about being with a pew pal?
I mean, I think just going back, like those adults that would be the pew pals were the ones that would continue to converse with us throughout church life. So whether they were coming over to babysit us or we would sit with them at church picnics or potlucks, like it was an enriching experience. It was a relationship, not just someone to tell us to be quiet.
So it became an entryway to something more, mm-hmm. which we hadn't planned on, but that's what evolved.
And it also shaped, as we had more kids come whose parents weren't active for whatever reason, it meant they all had at least two adults that they could go to, but they had to be with one or the other of those. Mm-hmm. So if they are in the sanctuary, they have to be with an adult, with a pupil. And they all just, because they didn't mind being around adults, this was cool being accepted and an adult who wanted them to be with them in church. So it spread out as our community engagement increased.
Right. Go ahead.
Do it sort of informally. That happens a lot in our churches. We've got a lot of small children in a very tiny church. A lot of there's single women who maybe don't have children for whatever reason, and actually love being invited to have a child sit with them or to take them as this child up to communion. Is this thing they describe as nourishing? I'm like, you can have my kids. but it can mean that there's a need for nurturing in that way.
Yeah. So it was a two-way street. Mm-hmm. You know, what was originally came up as parents saying, you need to get our kids out of the sanctuary. We can't worship. We need to at least have one space where, you know, we're not having to tend to our kids. Mm-hmm. It started as problem solving for that. It emerged and grew into something that created nourishment for adults that we didn't think that wasn't even on anybody's mind, and it created nourishment for the children. So it became something that nobody could have predicted. I also want to say that there were adults in the congregation who were not so keen on all this. And were kind of bothered by what they said was more noise and or more movement. Why can't they sit still? Blah blah. And so we actually invited them to sit in a different part of the sanctuary. So it's like that part of the sanctuary the kids don't tend to gravitate towards. So why don't you sit over there? And then the
kids.
Well, but also just honoring that for them
sure.
It was distracting, and so but rather than say, okay, well, we won't do this because it bothers you,
yeah.
You know, creating a place for them too, as we are trying to create a place for the children, and then, you know, saying let's continue to converse, let's continue to see what does this look like, what will it, because we all need to worship. It's not that you're being sacrificed now. For the children, that is not the message. So I just want to say that it wasn't all smooth sailing. So anyway, after we moved more deeply into the children's work, we more deliberately set up a transition education formation for children that were under school age. deliberately move into what we called big worship for the whole town. And that basically looked like taking different parts of worship, and they would have some instruction and have some reflection. They would do it in a way that was age appropriate, and they would be in worship for that part, and then they would reflect on it next week. Then they would take another portion of worship, so that there was some understanding of what are these people doing and why do they do what they do, and to introduce them to the symbols and let those symbols begin to be planted inside them. So we had a formal liturgy where they were welcomed into big worship, and they had a physical object they had made, which was a decorated candle that was lit from the Christ candle. That was their physical object to say this: they were transitioning out of this child space into big worship. We were active in schools. There was an elementary school in the neighborhood that the kids, we didn't actually have any kids that went there, but we had a master teacher in our children's group, and so we got some entree there through them, and the Mission Covenant group provided snacks for the teacher training that we were offering, and that really elicited some new relationships and connection again into the neighborhood. So in addition to worship, we also had a weeknight gathering. So Noah, what do you remember about that weeknight gathering?
So again, it seemed like a lot of our church activities were always around food of some sort. And so this was an evening where, again, it was kids and adults. We'd all have dinner together. And then the adults would do their adult Bible study, and then a different adult every week would take the kids, and we would do different things. So it wasn't just like you had a child care person that we hired or anything, but it was a different adult every week, whether that was the senior pastor or the children's director or whoever. And we would do different things like go to the library across the street or walk around the neighborhood or watch a movie, or our pastor actually took us and broke us into the golf course. But just the idea that we weren't just getting pawned off, that again, it was all the adults were participating while still giving a space for the adults to have their intentional study time. And yeah, so what was that about, or why did you do it that way?
It's the same kind of priorities. How do we have... We knew that there were times where adults needed space, or high schoolers on up needed space for Bible study time, but we wanted it to start with everybody's in the room, having a meal together. Kids didn't have a kids' table. It was conversation between adult and down to the smallest children. And then, as Noah said, library, other activities. Sometimes it was just homework time, and we made sure. But it was two or three different adults, actually, that went with them each time, but that meant the adults of the church rotated and weren't doing this more than once every 5 or 6 weeks. And that was because the kids were getting relationships in with all the adults, and the adults were getting to know the kids. And so just those relationships were developed while we did the Bible study time. And then, as Nina said, we were working by then with kind of a Wesleyan approach to covenant and mission. So our mission covenant groups often would meet after that, but then we'd need, certain kids needed to get home. If their parents were in a mission covenant group, kind of had to see whose parent was at whose home. But there was a year in there where Nina was in a covenant group that met at our house, and so our boys could, head to bed. But then another couple, both were in different mission covenant groups, but they were in different homes because of parenting needs. So I actually went to their home. They had three young boys, grade school down. So I read them to sleep on Wednesday nights for a year while their parents were off in other places. But again, that gave me a deeper relationship with these three boys. So that was just what that Wednesday night was like as a church family. So what else do you remember about adult friends in these years?
Adult friendships were, I didn't know the difference between adults and kid relationships. And so those, and it, while sometimes it would be like in the church context of worship, at other times it would be me walking down the block to play hide and go seek with a Cal grad student, or walking close to another guy's house who had chickens, and getting to hang out with him. And then there was a time where my parents went to Paris, and instead of, usually you would have like a family member stay with you for like the week that they're gone, but we actually had like four different couples that stayed with us, and we had a relationship with each of them, and they just entered into our home and took care of us for that week. And so again, it's those relationships. When they babysat us, we thought of it as play dates. And then there were also the bigger church gatherings like picnics or camping trips. And so there was like a camping trip where my parents couldn't go, but instead I just went up with another couple. And that was normal. And we would have sports times where, again, it was very intentional that it's not the kids that were going to be participating. So there were, they would split up the kids on both teams. There was intentional rules of like, you have to pass to a child every other, whatever we were playing. But again, that it was, we were part of the process of the, of whatever activity we were doing. We weren't just here given to the children's pastor, go off and do your thing. And part of that was also being in relationship with adults and seeing as they would be working within their own lives and seeing how they interacted with one another. And that was probably one of the most deepest forming things, was watching, like, for instance, there was a woman, older woman, who needed a new roof. And so the adults of the church took a weekend and just donated their time and put a new roof on her house. And that was just part of the life of the church. And so seeing different things like that, of being in the schools, being soccer coaches for community teams, having, like, we had different people that were involved with, like, Habitat for Humanity, or helping different families that couldn't afford it remodel their homes. And then also seeing different adults, like Dad said, babysitting for one each other, for each other, as they were doing different things and being in conversation with one another. And that was forming. Like, we were in relationship with them, wasn't just watching them do it, but actually being able to participate in that. And then also, it was just then part of the different things that led us to be able to see that better was, like I said, like the co-housing projects, where there was 10 families all living together. A lot of them had kids. And again, it was just like, this is part of how life is done together. That we, kids and adults, are living together and interacting together. It's not separate, it's all together. So,
I was thinking on that, on the co-housing, as Noah had a key role in praying for that, because mm-hmm. when we had bought an apartment building and remodeled it for us to live in as a family, and then there were two other units, and out the backyard was where there was a vacant lot, an old farmhouse, and started talking about what is that, and could that be used in some way with our friends, our church family, and Nina had invited Noah to be praying. And eventually we were able to purchase it and then divide it in a way for the development as a co-housing project with other families. And when after we closed the sale, the realtor came over, we directed her to say, when you knock, there's going to be an 8-year-old for the door. Do give the keys to him. And so everybody was there to kind of celebrate, okay, we've got the keys. And Noah, as the recognized prayer warrior at that point, got the keys and celebrated. And I also remember one of those, a couple years before that even, when you were 6 or 7, we already were involved with Habitat. We had another housing group that was doing a lot of stuff and just started to dream about co-housing. One year when Noah, we were getting ready for Noah's birthday party, and he made a Lego house as a bank, and he asked if his friends, instead of presents, could bring money for the houses we were helping other people build. And so his kids were coming to his birthday party, they were putting their money into this Lego house, and the parents were coming over and saying, did you make him do that? You know, is this, why do you make your kid not get presents? You know, they were saying, this really wasn't our idea. It was his idea. As a 6 or 7 year old, this is what, and as far as we know, this is just what Noah was picking up around the church. This is the way we live life, with our neighbors, with our money, with our time. And so he did that on his birthday parties from there on out. I can pause a little bit because we're going to get up to a transition, but just because we're going to then, we're moving to from Oakland to Pasadena, just any things that you want to ask about before we push into that and more his teen years.
So how long a time period?
So this was 0 to 9 for Noah. So he was born in 91, we moved to 2000. Mm-hmm. Or anything you're seeing here, because most of this is Rock Ridge. A few of the slides are Altadena, Pasadena. But
are you going to talk about, as you transitioned, how did this church remain engaged?
Let me just do that briefly, because that obviously we weren't there. The church didn't survive. Mm-hmm. It was there for about another 3 or 5 years. About the time we left, the pastor also went elsewhere, and the denomination really didn't know what to do with a missionally engaged, multicultural tithing congregation. And put a pastor in. And I probably had 3 phone calls from him just saying, why are these mission covenant groups so important? And he was moving back toward committees and taking initiative. He said, these are great people, but he kept changing everything and wasn't good at listening to what was kind of going on. And it didn't survive 5 years. I mean, the church literally dispersed. Now those people are out actually in other Methodist churches and the Covenant Church and some others. So the leadership really was diffused, and some God really did something with that. And co-housing's still there, and those people by and large are still significantly engaged, but again in different churches. But as a congregation, it didn't last 5 years, which was obviously sad for us, but God redeems and keeps.
That's the irony.
It just makes you pause.
It makes you become Catholic.
It's one solution.
I resonate with that. I'm Methodist. I'm in my second appointment.
Okay.
And we worked so hard in our first appointment to help move churches towards more regular communion, more than once a month. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we left, the pastor who followed us asked the congregation if they would consider.
Yeah, you really don't like doing this every week.
You're gonna be kidding me.
That's back to the old norm.
So that's just one of those huge struggles. And I read
the book. Yeah. We used the Methodist liturgy. Our musicians had written music for all of it. So you saw there's 16 songs sung in the video. But most of that were the weekly liturgy songs. We sang it, and the kids grew up singing the Great Thanksgiving. The gospel in a box. They didn't do it every week, but it was some physical thing and a song. Gospel in a box, pass it on. And he'd name the names of the kids while he'd do this. But you're doing a guessing game, and it's some object lesson. So this was Black History Month. The object lesson was a peanut and George Washington Carver. And the gifts of God that become gifts for the people of agriculture and peanuts and how many things peanuts were made into. And then the lesson that week was on gifts and spiritual gifts and other gifts that God. So he was creative at putting these things together.
Is that pastor still around?
No. Yeah, he actually moved out of the denomination.
He's a carpenter.
Yeah. Noah's ended up working for his brother, actually, at another Methodist church, but that's another story.
Yes.
So it was like there were 13 adult members when we came, all living in the suburbs, driving in, keeping watch, and it voted to close.
Right, who were like over 75, yeah, all of them.
I mean, you saw a couple of them there, and especially because there was another African-American church then that merged with us as we started to grow because they felt welcomed. So you saw some of those And then that group kind of grew with their kids and grandkids. By the time we left, there were a little over, there's around 100 on a set. So we used condominium law in California because co-op law is a lousy law, but it's still basically co-ownership, 9 units, everything from studios to 4-bedroom, but all church members that were basically engaged in the community, engaged in the schools, engaged in soccer, engaged in, so, and one of the strange things was as we literally were just a few months into people moving in before we left. So we'd worked for years at this. This is one of the hard things to leave for us. And especially, we're amazed at the impact of co-housing on Noah, even though he didn't actually live. These were his friends. He'd lived with them for years in church. But as far as actually living co-housing together, it'd been 3-4 months. Mm-hmm. But they're still there. They still have common life. You know. Yeah, each unit is fully its own. Mm-hmm. And common meals twice a week. Shift in cooking for that. So there are a lot of other common things. And in the slides, again, I'll run them later, the gardens and stuff. So the transition, I get a phone call from Fuller asking me to teach, and I literally said no 4 times. I just didn't want to be a professor. We didn't want to move. I didn't even tell Nina when I got the invitation to do this. Just was totally outside imagination. So it was, that's just to say, this was a long, hard discernment process where eventually we did decide to go. But Noah, how do you remember, you were 8 at that time, as we started engaging this thinking?
Yeah, so again, I think this is a good example of we were always involved in, often in the process. This wasn't a decision made behind closed doors where all of a sudden we're moving, but something where we were engaged, and so a lot of memories of, as we were really thinking about this, there was a couple trips down to Pasadena and looking at the schools and looking at the city, and then even in our home, having different church leaders, pastors coming over, leading prayer times of discernment and conversation and reflection around this decision. But again, like those times weren't held behind closed doors. They were in my living room. And so, like, I was sitting there in the middle of the living room as they were having these meetings. And so for me, like, being part of this community, growing up in this community, having co-housing just starting, I didn't want to move at all. Like, I remember praying that we wouldn't move. So
we got to the decision. It was actually a full year from the first query I had from Fuller. And I just got back from the Philippines. Pieces were falling in place. We were approaching that. I flew down to Pasadena again for a Saturday morning meeting and came back, and that had firmed up the decision for us. And so that evening, Noah, as we're at dinner, Noah literally just looks at me and says, "You've decided, haven't you?" Mm-hmm. I said yes, and he started having tears. I'm going to still do it. You know, tears for me too. He gets into my lap, and he just says, "There's some things we're going to miss." Yeah, I said, "Let's talk about what we're going to miss." And he said, "My friends." And I said, "Okay, let's just name them. Let's name the friends." And he names 10 friends, just like that, and 6 of them were adults. And they weren't necessarily my best friends. I mean, these were the people that he had pushed into his life and he pushed into theirs. And it just was, in the midst of the sadness, it created this great joy in me of what we'd wondered about 9 years earlier. Can adults and kids be church together? And God had really granted that and had engaged that and funded that as he wanted to before we even thought of asking. So that was just a remarkable gift to us. And so we moved to Pasadena in 2000, summer.
Right. So we started attending a Presbyterian church, and that was historically Japanese American. It was, an older congregation, very few kids. And I think that's probably all I need to tell you about that church for now. So, honey, what do you remember about about this new church that we started going to?
I think, again, it was that this church was not this one. It was new, but I still had the same patterns that I'd already grown up with, so I was already engaging with the adults and...
didn't know any better.
I just didn't know any better. And so one of the first ways I was engaged in this congregation was the associate pastor, who was also a music director, asking if I wanted to play piano. And I'd been playing for 5 or 6 years, and so I was 11 by this time, and she just invited if I would want to play for the worship time. And that actually ended up being incredibly formative as music became one of the main mediums that I interacted with God in my own worship and prayer life, eventually becoming one of my majors in college and one of my vocations, even now, being a music director at a church.
So the first Sunday that Noah played for the congregation, I sat with him at the piano bench because his legs weren't quite long enough to reach the sustain pedal. And so I was the pedal person, and he played. And after the service was over, all these adults came up to me and thanked me for playing. They had just assumed I was playing and that Noah, for some mysterious reason, was sitting on the bench next to me. So
a week or two after that, Steve Yamaguchi, who's a good friend, is now Dean of Students at Fuller, was there as a guest preacher. And he told me later on, after the service, he said, when he was getting ready to preach, he looked over as everybody's milling around, and there's this kid sitting on the piano bench. And he said, we're about ready to start service. That kid better find his parents. And then he started playing the introit. So so again, Noah was starting to find, you know, we were hoping again for this kind of intergenerational, but it was new for this church. And we didn't know how it's gonna become that. But like I say, Noah didn't know any better, and gradually we did see some progress that way. One of my good friends, Jim Sakamoto, a couple years in now, but his wife had passed away, and he had developed cancer, and so was in his last months. And 3-4 nights a week, I would just drive over to his house, hang out with him, get stories. He still was feeling good enough to tell stories, and God really had given us a friendship. And Noah wanted to go, and so I'd say, sure, and, you know, join me. And so he would actually just come over. He would just literally lie down on the living room floor as Jim and I talked story. And one night, Jim was both a kind and could sound a little gruff. And one night, Jim turns to Noah and says, "Noah, why do you want to hang out with an old man who's dying?" And Noah just didn't miss a beat. He says, I like the stories. I like being here. And he just, you know, they talked some too, but it just was so interesting. Both of them felt okay engaging this. Jim at least asked Noah instead of asking me. And Noah's response, just, this is why we're in this life together, is to hear and listen to each other. So we had used, both in Rock Ridge and then in Altadena, the Godly Play curriculum, which I think probably a lot of you know, Montessori-based, very story, Bible-based. And so Noah had that again at Altadena, and then you started moving to middle school and high school youth group. So tell us that.
So when I first started in the youth group, it was pretty small. There's 3 of us. But one of the decisions early on, we wanted to go on a fishing trip instead of a big entertainment-based church camp. And that actually got attention of some of the other kids in the neighborhood that were actually looking for a church. And so then as that group developed, at first, well, even that first fishing trip ended up being a bigger group, and we started living into a more practice-based way of being together. And so part of that was we invited our families and a couple of our seniors to come with us. And so that was forming for us. It was, again, it was generations being together. In our weekly youth groups, It was always around a meal. It was always like tactile learning where we were engaging with what we were learning. It wasn't this entertainment, here's a video, here's some quick worship time. And so at the beginning, at first, the adults were really planning these times for us, even outside of just like the Sunday youth group, of these intentional youth nights and things like that, where we'd be in each other's homes and doing different activities. But as the years went on and I was in middle to late high school, those started shifting where we actually were just doing it ourselves. That was just part of our practices. We went over to each other's houses as groups, and we were hanging out together, making meals for ourselves. And then along with that was these summer trips to partner with other churches in different cities, of doing different work with them, different service projects and staffing church camps. And those were incredibly forming too. Again, getting their stories, different cultures, and seeing the way that God was working in different communities. And one of the things that was, we always got kind of some confusion whenever we walked into any place, was our youth group was probably like four or five different cultures. And so multi-generational, our leaders was an African-American woman and a Caucasian man. And so just like very diverse, while every other youth group we were meeting was usually of the same ethnicity. And so again, multi-ethnicity is multi-generational. And on these trips, they not only formed us with interacting with the people that where we were, but also with each other. So like we had everyone from middle school to high school. We would do this all together. And part of the trip at the end was we took time for each person, and everyone in the youth group would name the way that they saw God in that person during that week. And that just created some incredible relationships and people you wouldn't expect. And so, like, for one of the trips, and I had some pretty close friends in the youth group, but instead of hanging out with them, I was hanging out with the 11-year-old, just because that was just what we did, and that was forming, and we bonded to each other. And you also saw on, like, one of the last trips that we did, it was we had our adult leaders, but it was the senior youth that really ended up taking over. And so we were planning the groceries that we needed and what time we had to wake up, and we would actually go wake up our own leaders. And this was just part of what we were doing. And that they, by being in that environment and the way that we were formed, that we were taking those things on as our own.
You know, one background on the fishing trip, this was, like you said, was a Japanese American church. And that had actually come out of some stories the kids had heard, because from the internment, one of the places that internment had happened during World War was Manzanar on the eastern slope of the Sierras. And after the first year and a half or so, the government would let a handful of men go up and fish in certain lakes there in the eastern Sierras. And later on, some of them had actually bought cabins then at Mammoth. And so they knew the lakes, they actually owned property, and they were the ones that invited the youth group then. It was out of those stories, stay in this cabin, we know the lakes. And then Manzanar since then has become an absolutely amazing national center with story and exhibit and stuff. So then that's on the way. So they would be there with the storytellers, with the people who had been interned as kids and as teenagers during World War II. So it was thickening the lives, the stories.
And the youth group was involved in the life of the church. Like, as we were being involved in each other's lives, there was ways where, like, I was on the worship team, where a guy was doing sound, another girl was doing child care. It wasn't something they told us to do, it was something we wanted to do. We weren't assigned, but it was part of just being in the life of the church again, and that those relationships came out of that.
So what do you remember about home life that was formative?
Some of the things around home was different practices that basically spaces where they that was safe time. So, like, we had intentional dinner time where we would have devotions. And a lot of these, again, were just stories. It was just stories about different missionaries or people of faith that had different things. We had, like, intentional reading times with both mom and dad, as well as dad would take us to coffee every other week. And I think the thing that was important about this was it created space where we felt free to ask any of the questions that we were dealing with as kids and teenagers going through school. And by then, I was in a secular public school. And so, I mean, it was everything from, is there life after death? What is, like, end times look like? To what about cussing? And what about war? And why don't you let me see R-rated movies? Like, all of that. But those were questions we could bring up because there was these times that were set aside that were felt safe for us. And beyond that, it was also, there was always this openness to engage with other adults, or even somewhat of encouraging to engage with other adults. And for me, that was also a seeing of my parents were able to say, like, we don't have all the answers. Here's another person you could engage with. And as I looked around at my other friends or talked to my other friends, that was pretty rare. I had even a friend who had talked to some of the other people in our adults in our youth group, a mom and a youth pastor. And when her mom found out that she had been talking about some stuff she even told her mom, she actually she had to struggle with that. So that was just part of home life. And a big thing that I think was probably most formative, which is coming back to the idea of making decisions and being in the process, was almost every decision that we were making, we were involved in the process. So, like, when I was switching schools, I was involved in that process of what did you think about the school? What do you think you want to do?
You were going from elementary to middle school.
Right, yeah. And that, again, it wasn't like you're going here or we're going to do this. So it could be everything from deciding what school to go to a consequence for something we did, to what chores. And if they came up with, we think this is a consequence that would be fitting for whatever you did, it was always open for us to come back and be like, what about this? A different proposal. That it wasn't dictatorial, it was a conversation. And in that, we gained understanding of what we were doing and able to self-regulate ourselves. And so was all this intentional? And how much wasn't intentional? How much of what was just flying by the seat of your pants?
But obviously, it's all planned. We're on top of all this stuff, right? You know how much anybody here, parenting is experimental all the time. You're trying. The kids, these two boys are so incredibly different. And so it was constant negotiating in that way. I want you to get it, before we push more into some of that, is some of your comments about the, we'd spend a week each summer with like four or five other families, couples, that was a mix of recreation and Bible study. But what that time was like, because that was year after year during 10 of those years.
Yeah, so we would go up to Big Bear, and it was adults from all over the world, really. There was connections through InterVarsity, and they would spend a week up there, and the adults would be studying a book of the Bible, and often for 5 to 10 years. But one of the things that I remember the most of seeing is, again, in the afternoons, different adults would take the kids and do different activities. It wasn't the same adult usually. It was different ones. They wanted to engage with us. And another thing was that every evening, the adults would share stories about their lives. So it would just be updating them on what happened this year. But at the beginning, the first sharing time was always they had the kids do it. So we would share with what was happening this year. And then it was intentional to have an adult pray for us. And then because those stories were being told at the beginning of the week. The adults then, during different meal times and other times, would then engage with us around what had happened during that year. So again, it was this intentional being able to see adults wanting to be a part of our lives, us having a place within the process of life, and then also seeing it as adults were caring for each other and sharing their stories and struggles throughout the year, that the messiness of life and the process of life was not hidden from us, that we were really seeing these adults that were, I mean, missionaries and professors and pastors that were leaders in their communities, but seeing them sharing with one another and processing hard times with one another and victories as well. And that was part of life.
And there are different times that Mom and I have had professional lives in the midst of all this. So how did you experience that?
So I think one of the main things was, even though there were separate times where one parent was the primary one home or working, that me and my brother never felt there was always time for us. Time would always be made for us. And so whether we had to just get an essay done and that we wanted help on that, that was never a burden or we were put off. That even though they were working their full-time jobs, that there was always at least some space within the day that was set aside for us that we felt prioritized. And I know that they were both very busy doing whatever they were doing, but the feeling from us was that we had all the time in the world.
During the Oakland years, I had been home dad. Nina had had a more than full-time job. Wasn't quite our idea of the switch, but when we moved to Pasadena, I ended up with more than a full-time job. And Nina did other part-time stuff, but really became home mom. So there was some intentional stuff on our part there that we remember.
Were you in public school at that time?
I wasn't. So when we moved, I was in private school for 3 years, and then I moved into the public schools. Mm-hmm. And my brother did the same.
So in our home, Mark and I had, our hope was that we would have, we would raise young men that would love God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, and their neighbors as themselves. But just trying to figure out how to get there. And so, or not that we could really say, but anyway, some of the things that we considered was just trying to figure out how did we give them practices? How did we give them experience and discernment and being able to recognize the voice of God? How could we give them experience and skills in hearing through the Word of God? So the devotions, the prayer times, the including them in processes that were both kind of critical thinking, but as well as discernment, exercising more the intuitive ability, was just all part of the kind of the palette we wanted to give them, because we knew they would need to have their own relationships with God. I think some of the most challenging parts of that for me was figuring out how to do that in a way that was developmentally appropriate. So, for example, you don't let a two-year-old decide when to cross the street, but you do allow a 12-year-old to do that. That is appropriate work for a 12-year-old. And that the consequences that might have to be dealt with if a wrong decision is made or a bad decision is made. And that was another piece, is okay, this really is your decision, and the weight of it and the possible consequences, are those appropriate for that age? That they might have to bear consequences of a bad choice. Because that too, you can learn from. And so trying to kind of squelch my desire to not have them suffer, and to know that that's part of growing up, and that's part of learning how to listen for the voice of God, making decisions, discerning, was a big piece. Did you want to add anything to that?
I just think part of that, too, is that how they would watch us, like with Noah, your involvement in, on the board of 10,000 Villages also opened up the chance for Noah early in high school to work at 10,000 Villages as a clerk. So he's actually got a cash register, he's actually learning a job, or he'd be with me on protests against war and peace vigils we have in Pasadena, and Noah was watching me and my adult friends, Reggie and others, the colleagues that were involved in this. And he would want to be with us in our lives and was welcomed into our lives in those ways.
So, Noah, what do you remember about money?
So, got an allowance, I don't even know when, probably around 10. And I mean, allowance being at this time like $1 or $2 a week. And part of it was, all the way up through high school, we had a checkbook where we would keep track of how much money we had. And so we had actually had to enter when we asked for money for different things, what that was and how much that was, and we would deduct it and everything. So keeping track of how much money we had. And then another part was every Christmas we were given $1,000 each to give away to a project of our choice. So whether that was World Vision, Heifer Project, helping build a school in Afghanistan. But it was this idea of we were giving away more than we were receiving. And those practices were forming, too, to where, like, every, you know, 3 to 4 months, I would give away, you know, $20 here or there to, like, Heifer Project. And so, again, those, because those practices were just part of our life, then I was doing it myself. And I don't even remember making that conscious decision. It was just like, that's just what we do. So
just other...
I just have a... I'm sorry. When you did that with the money at Christmas, mm-hmm. was there a way in which you knew, like, how much you were receiving and how much value that was, or was it just...
I think it was pretty clear. Okay. And the gifts that we got, I mean, it was not $1,000 worth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Couldn't be confused. And one of the things, because often I would know somebody who just got back from earthquake recovery in India or teaching in Palestine and building schools in Palestine or somebody building a school in Afghanistan, I would, whenever possible, get a phone call with a worker there. And they would always welcome a conversation with our boys, mm-hmm. you know, because they knew what we're trying to do is have sons understand, here's what money can do, and here is the relationship you've got with Christians around the world, or with God's people around the world. And they would, I remember this guy just back from literally pulling people out of the rubble in India, oh yeah, let me call him, when can I call him, when are they going to be home, and would talk to him about what it meant to be the church in India at that time. And it was just an education you can't get any other. Yeah, it was just stunning. So, closing songs going on there. So, Noah, as then into college and into grad school, what else do you reflect on that was formative?
So, just the ideas of once me and my brother were getting into college and being, like, slightly distanced from being in the family, of really seeing ways that this idea of being in process and having flexibility within structure was, in a lot of ways, very unique. And so, like, for instance, I had friends when they would come back from their freshman year of college, all of a sudden they had curfews and, like, all these things where, again, my mom and my dad's ideas of figuring out what is developmentally appropriate of for us when we got home, it was just know, like, where are you going, let us know where you're going, you're an adult. And so, again, that flexibility. But one of the biggest things was just the idea of process. How do you think through something well? How do you discern with God, reflection, and intellectually, in relationship with others. And so one of the things my brother said even like 3 weeks ago, he just kind of randomly does this. He'll just like come into a room, you'll be doing whatever you're doing, he'll just sit down and say something random. And so what he said was, have you noticed that we're a lot smarter than a lot of our friends, and that's mom and dad's fault?
Obviously, I didn't pass on the modicum of humility I have.
And what he was really getting at, as we were talking a little more, was this idea of how do you process? How do you think through decisions? How do you weigh the different things in life as you're balancing like what you want to do in life and the consequences of your decisions? And he was talking about this and trying to find like a relationship romantic partner. I'm just like, I can't find someone that's smart, like, which is another thing.
He's also not listening well.
But that, I mean, even, and he's had his own journey, but even just
that's a nice word.
That these processes were formative, and even in challenging times, and so I think that's what I take away the most is this idea of process, this idea of being involved in life with different adults at different stages and different community, and that really was formative for how me and him both do life now. And in our conversations as like 9 and 10 year olds having conversations with adults and really listening to their wisdom, and that is formative. And valuing the idea of being open, not hiding your own like struggles and weaknesses, being really open with them and talking about them in process, and that's how you do healing. That's what a community does by bearing each other's burdens. These are the things that we were walking away with, even now. And it's powerful to then when you're talking with other people who haven't done this, and being able to help others be able to start to enter in how do you process, and giving that gift to other people of how do you make a big decision? Let's think through these things. Why don't you talk with a mentor? Why don't you read about this? Why don't you pray about it? It's just it was a way of doing life.
Any other questions? Things you've seen here or things have been raised? There's the co-housing after the trees grew up. So you'd also commented, just maybe closing, about how you've seen the messiness in these lives, too. This is not all straight Wesleyan holiness. and what that's been like.
So I mean, I think there were times where we were protected from some of that, but at the same time, remembering different things like my godparents getting divorced and different kids out of wedlock, different struggles of the adults around us, but what it meant to be church amongst the struggle. And so, like, for my youth group, which was really cool, is all of the kids out of that youth group at Altadena are still very strong professing of their faith, but that it's not been pretty. Different ones have drug problems, been gangs, have kids out of wedlock. Yet that this formation of there's always been church and adults around them and ability to fall into your community, and that's forming. And that's what the church is all about.
I think our time's up.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We can hang out a bit. So we can hang out more if you want to buzz.